Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Renee Powers here, and we've got another great interview for you today. I hope you don't mind the kind of offset schedule that we're working with right now. I've mentioned before that we are going through some changes with the podcast, and we're bringing on contributors, we're bringing on correspondents, and we've got a lot of interviews that have been pre-recorded that I want to get into your ears before those changes take place. Today's interview is with Catherine McKinley, the author of The African Lookbook. I have to tell you, this book is unlike anything I've read before. It is a collection of images, and I think I tell her at one point that reading this book is like walking through a very well-curated art exhibit. So Catherine is an art collector as well. And so she has put her collection into this book and shared her thoughts and the history behind a lot of the images. This book is for somebody who loves art, for someone who loves fashion, but also history, politics, and economics, and anyone who like misses going to a museum, honestly. So I hope that you pick this book up and just check it out, because I think the reading experience of it is really interesting, and unlike a lot of the nonfiction books that are out there right now. So stay tuned for that. First, I have to remind you that our March theme is Read Caribbean. So our book subscription box is going to have all Caribbean products, and it is featuring the book Here Comes the Sun by Nicole Dennis Benn. We're doing this in collaboration with Decentered Lit, our fellow book box friends down in Jamaica, and they have helped us curate this box too. So I'm really excited to share those products with you. Make sure you check out our Instagram for some sneak peeks. And they have selected our charity of the month, which is Eve for Life, which works with women and girls living with HIV. It is an incredible organization, and Decentered Lit brought them to our attention, and we're really excited to be featuring them and supporting them this month. 5% of all of our sales are donated to charity, and that's all of our sales across everything. We calculate our revenue at the end of the month and then just cut a 5% check. It is actually one of the joys of this work, is writing that check and sending it off. So we appreciate you. We appreciate listening, and we appreciate your patience with us as we transition this podcast to be multi-voice and a little different. I'm really excited for it. I think that you'll really enjoy it once it is off the ground, and I can't wait for you to hear the new episodes and meet everybody. We'll be coming at you in just a few weeks, and we're going to launch the new version 2.0, Feminist Book Club Podcast 2.0, sometime in March, so stay tuned for that. But for now, enjoy this conversation with Catherine McKinley, author of The African Lookbook. I'm so excited today to talk to Catherine McKinley. Catherine E. McKinley is a curator and writer whose books include the critically acclaimed Indigo, which is a journey along the ancient indigo trade routes in West Africa, and The Book of Sarahs, a memoir about growing up Black and Jewish in the 1960s to 80s. She's taught creative nonfiction writing at Sarah Lawrence College and Columbia University. And today we are discussing her new book, The African Lookbook, which features the McKinley Collection, a personal archive representing African photographies from 1870 through the present. Welcome, Catherine.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to dive into this book with you, but we always start with the same question for all of our guests, and that is, what does it mean to you to be feminist?
To be feminist, I'm a 60s child, but I was in college and part of high school in the 80s. So I really grew up under, you know, like a new and important wave of Black feminist thought. And so I feel very much informed by that, and then very forward thinking in the sense that I spent a lot of time living outside of the US, in Africa in particular, where a lot of those ideas were in sync, but also challenged. So feminism to me, I guess I've grown into a feeling like there are feminisms and that it's important to really broaden and constantly challenge what we're thinking about when we talk about gender.
Absolutely. And I love that your feminism is informed by your upbringing and your travels and the people that you've talked to and spent time with. And mm-hmm. I know that you mentioned earlier that feminism can be a tricky word for African and Black women. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack, but you know, feminism is a word that I'm still not entirely comfortable with, although I live a fully feminist life. It still has a lot of kind of colonial and Western underpinnings that feel uncomfortable to me, that really chafe at me. And so I'm always thinking about that and thinking about how we can, you know, how to talk about that and how to represent that feeling or those notions in my work in particular. And because I spend so much of my creative time and personal time in Africa, I'm thinking all the time about the really kind of uncomfortable tensions between political thought and how people live. Mm-hmm. So those are all kind of the things that make up who I am as a feminist and how I conceive of feminism. And when you look at gender in particular and how it's exploded into all these interesting forms and thoughts, and there are a lot of contradictions and a lot of things pulling at each other, I'm hoping that feminism will start to do that, to go through that same kind of process.
Yeah. I love all the contradictions within feminism, to be honest. I think it keeps us humble and it keeps us thinking.
Definitely.
Well, I would love for you to share with our audience, what is the African Lookbook? Introduce us to this, because it is unlike anything we have featured on the podcast up to now. And so I'm really excited to highlight it, but I would love for you to give us kind of your elevator pitch for it.
Okay. I started about roughly 20 years ago. I started really informally collecting photographs of African women. It was tied to research I was doing for my Indigo book, and also to personal relationships with people that I met as I was traveling, who would give photos as gifts at the end of the time that we spent together. And so it started as a collection, and then it grew into a desire to share the work, to not have the work kind of rest as an archive that was private, that was inert in some way. I wanted to activate the archive. And so I started to think about, well, how do I do that? Do I do it curatorially? And I did do a little bit of exhibition work. And then I started to feel like, okay, I want this part of the largest possible public conversation. So I kind of returned to book writing, which is my, you know, that's where my roots are. And so I'm taking a section of the archive and I'm knitting a narrative that looks at African women and their relationship to fashion. And embedded in fashion is politics, political expression, and the trade, which was always important to African women's economic life, the trade in cloth in particular. So that's really what it is. It's a kind of examining the photography, the history of the photography, alongside the history of dressmaking and all the potentials that fashion had for self-expression and political expression.
Reading it feels like wandering a beautifully curated museum. Mm. I was in Bangkok about a year ago, and I toured the Queen Mother has a textile museum of all of her dresses and uniforms and things she's worn over the years. And it was just fascinating to see the history behind the textiles and the cloth and the influences of her fashion. And it reminded me so much, this book reminded me so much of that experience. And it was so, you know, we can't go to museums right now.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite things. And so it was
a nice replacement for being unable to get out and wander a museum, because there's these beautiful photographs that have been paired with explanations and histories and context. And it's so well curated.
Oh, thank you.
I have to ask, how did you decide? I know that your collection is huge. So how did you decide what to include in this book?
It was hard. It was a long process. It took a lot longer than I expected. But I guess at some point I was deciding on how I could build a narrative out of the photos. So what kind of erupted out of the photos that would link to the larger narrative. And so that meant cutting out some things that I like quite a bit that I just either didn't know enough about the photos, or it wasn't, you know, kind of interesting enough to what I had laid out. So it became this kind of funny process, but I think it hangs together. And even then it felt like a struggle constantly to pull everything back towards one kind of central idea.
And what to you is that central idea?
It's really the idea of, you know, I was a kid that loved to dress. I loved fashion. I had a mother who was the antithesis of that. And she, you know, she would kind of sneer at it and say, well, you better give it meaning, or you better make it interesting, or that things had to have substance. That was always her insistence. And I think that a lot of times, you know, historically, images of African women have rested so much on the bright splash of the clothing that's worn. And, you know, I was certainly attracted to that for a long time. But then I started to think, you know, what does it mean? How does this move beyond these kinds of, you know, beautiful dresses or bright displays? What's underneath, or what is the meaning of that bright display in an environment that seems almost antithetical to that? So, and, you know, this notion of like these extremely strong women who were in bright frilly dresses full of lace and that sort of thing, like how were they getting done the things that they were doing?
One of the things you write, I believe it's in the first chapter or maybe an introduction, is that cloth historically has been a more effective weapon than guns in mm-hmm. colonial domination. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that in particular.
Yeah, it was literally, cloth was traded in the transatlantic slave trade and the trade that predated that at a higher volume than arms. So cloth imports they kind of hovered from the 1600s through the early 20th century. They kind of hovered around 50 to 60% of goods that were traded. Cloth is so important to every aspect of African societies in most cultures. So it had an incredible value. And it was, you know, it was an easy selling point. So for instance, 2 yards of a certain kind of cotton cloth could buy a colonial power a human life. You know, so one slave would equal 2 yards of cloth. Or there were, you know, kind of approximate measures in all the historical documents. So that really fascinated me. That was that idea. What did it mean? Was it a society that was caught up in something so frivolous as fashion displays? Or was it that cloth had all these other inherent important meanings, which is in fact what it is?
Yeah. Fashion can be seen as so frivolous or meaningless, but this book, you argue, it's inherently political and powerful.
Yeah.
And I think at one point you use the phrase that it's the root of African women's power in a lot of ways. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Women have historically been very much involved in the making of textiles and the trade of textiles. And it was, you know, it's used heavily in dowries, so in marriage bids and in domestic life and in the upkeep of tradition. And all that is considered kind of women's work or women's culture. And so they've had a lot of command over the trade, but at the same time, it was one of the few areas of commercial life where they were able to amass enormous wealth, in a lot of cases, enormous wealth. And so if you look back in the historical documents, you see like in the 1500s in Nigeria, there were groups of women who were able to depose a king and gained control of the indigo trade there. And that had very far-reaching meanings in within that kingdom. And so, and you look later in the 1970s, where again, a group of Yoruba women depose a king around the indigo trade. There are just these kind of patterns in history where women have used the economic power of trading cloth to really exert enormous control. And cloth wealth is one of the sort of thing that you can tuck away somewhere. You know, you wear a dress, the dress is constructed in a way that it could be taken apart and you would have almost something pretty close to a whole cloth. And so that dress that you're wearing can be recycled as currency, and cloth was used as currency both in the colonial trade and in the pre-colonial trade. So somebody's dress was literally their wealth or their inheritance, or as a way to store. If your husband gave you a dowry of 30 cloths, that was capital. And that was capital that was beyond anybody's control or even beyond their sight, because it was something that was tucked away in your personal belongings.
And it never depreciates too.
Yes, never depreciates, because paper money is so volatile, and cloth, good cloth, has always either maintained or increased its value.
Yeah, I thought the direct line between women's economic power and economic freedom and fashion, what seems to be fashion, is so fascinating and not something I had ever thought of.
Yeah, we certainly don't think of it. I know that there are quite a few women that, you know, who use their husband's money to buy fashion and resell it. And I think that, you know, I've seen that become, I have a friend here, a Senegalese model, who actually used the fashion that she was given either through modeling or through, you know, being able to take money from a very controlling husband and bought a house on Central Park.
Wow.
So that's certainly, like, the principle is very much alive, and and I see it happen quite a bit, but it's mostly beyond our consciousness.
Yeah. One of the other things that you bring up involving fashion, and I want to move to the photography part of it shortly, but I have to ask about anchor fabrics, because that is something that I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. And I found that so poetic in how anchor fabrics are used. So can you tell our audience a bit about anchor fabrics in African cultures?
Mm-hmm. So a family, whether it's for a funeral or some other national occasion, it could be a presidential visit, it could be something more intimate, like a small group of women that work together in the market and cooperate in some way, they would select or order a cloth that is an expression of that group and that group's, you know, feelings and sentiments, et cetera. And they would take the cloth. So a family or a group of women or the nation on the occasion of a political visit would take the cloth, and everybody would sew a dress from it in their own particular style, and then make what they call an anchor and go out together. So you see all over West Africa and other parts of the continent, you'll see groups assembled where everybody's wearing the same fabric. And it's such a spectacle. It's really a powerful, beautiful thing. But underneath that are a lot of, well, there's a kind of religious, spiritual meaning, the notion that one's spirit is in their cloth, that you wear the cloth close to your body. It's the thin layer, the skin between your spirit and the outside world. And so a person's spirit is in their cloth. And so for everyone to join in that way is a strong spiritual bond. And people talk also of the idea of tying your cloth to another person's cloth. So if somebody has died, you'll hear women say, "Tie your cloth to my cloth and forget." Like, we're here to mourn together. We're here to help forget the pain of losing this person. And then on the street, you know, there have been occasions where I might admire someone's dress and say, "Oh, I love this person's dress. I want to ask where it was sewn or where they bought that cloth." People will say, "Hey, be careful. They'll think you're trying to steal their spirit." So anchor really, it becomes that kind of an expression. Here we would say, "Oh, that's too matchy-matchy." But on the continent, it's much more of a very, very deep expression of of kinship or solidarity.
I love that. I think that is so, I was just enamored by the photos of some anchor cloths and how they're tied together. I love that part of your book.
Thanks. You also see, you know, like for instance, George Bush went to Kenya at some point during his presidency and women there wrinkled the cloth with his face on it and wore it upside down so that his face was across their buttocks. And that was it's a form of political protest.
Yes. Yes. Also excited about that. Well, let's shift a little bit because this book to me feels like it's equal parts fashion, equal parts photography and the history of photography on the continent. And so tell me a little bit about what you saw, because your collection goes back all the way to 1870. Mm-hmm. What are some of the themes or what are some of the things that we would like to know that you think that are interesting that you've learned collecting and curating this?
Well, my first impression before I had really thought about any of this was that photography came late to the African continent. But in fact, it was less than 20 years since the invention of photography in the West. And right away, although the camera was a colonial tool, it was tied up in the colonial project, it was also taken up by African photographers and by returnees, so formerly enslaved Black people from the Caribbean, Brazil in particular, who had returned to Africa, were often at the forefront of the photography studios there. So as it was very, very shortly, particularly in Senegal, very, very shortly after the arrival of the camera through colonial channels that African photographers emerged. So when you really lay out the photos, there's just such an interesting breadth of people who are, you know, capturing images from those early years.
In one of your introductions to the book, you've got two powerhouses that have written introductions for this book, Jacqueline Woodson and Edwidge Duntecott. And Edwidge Duntecott, I think that she says that what started as kind of colonial pornography, that the gaze eventually shifted to the self and portraiture. I would love for you to talk a little bit about the shifts in the gaze over time and kind of a reclamation. It's how it read to me, a reclamation of the power of the subject in the photography too.
Mm-hmm. Well, very early on, you see a lot of kind of landscape photography and they would send people into the interior of countries to capture pictures of like church building or crop planting or that sort of thing. The early African photographers were starting to do studio photography. So they were doing portraits of African elites alongside working with colonial agents or other colonial photographers to do those kind of, you know, surveys of the empire. And then very soon after the arrival of photography in West Africa, the British government ordered that the camera be used specifically to capture types. So they were sending people into the field or quote unquote into the bush to capture as broad a catalog of human types as possible. So the kind of commissioned, lovely, the sitter is in control portraits that were happening on one hand, we're also being coupled with this cataloging. And you see a lot of that photography where, you know, Yoruba girl, age, whatever, you know, the kind of stiff, coerced portraiture. And then right alongside that, these very beautiful, much more languid portraits where there isn't that same obvious coercion or imbalance in power. And then I think in the 1920s, you start to see much more of this explosion of African photographers in studios primarily. And that's where, to me, that's where the fun really begins, because you see sitters of this broadening class of people. So it's not just the elites, but other people who are more aspirational or who may not have money, but were pulled into the studio by an African photographer and, you know, kind of allowed to be who they want to become in front of the camera. So that's a lot of what my collection's concerned with. I'm really interested in those portrayals. I'm also interested in the kind of straight colonial portrayals and the issues of power. And the book is kind of a mix of the two of them, but definitely privileging, you know, this other kind of portraiture, the self-commissioned portraiture.
What struck me as so joyful is the portraits that were taken in front of other portraits. Yes. That seems to be a theme of African photography and portraiture. Tell me a little bit more about that and kind of what the history is there and what the point of it is.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is coming out of Senegal. Senegal had some of the earliest and most prolific portrait studios and the most variety of studios. You know, there was really a sense like in Dakar around the turn of the century, there were studios, African studios with very, very distinct styles. There were Lebanese studios, there were European studios. And there was a sense of like, again, it was very aspirational, like, okay, I can afford this now, but I hope to be in this other studio at some point. And photos were very, very important to display. So people had a lot of portraiture in their home and they would borrow from each other. If there was a family occasion, a wedding or something like that, they would even go and borrow portraits from somebody else to, you know, really fill out the background. And I think those are the ones you're referring to.
Mm-hmm. I love those.
Yeah, they're fantastic. So, and it's funny because sometimes you can see the same portrait reappear, you know, in the background of another home or another locale. So those are brilliant. I love those.
Your ancestors are getting around to the different.
Yeah. But the Senegalese really had a sense of like the value of this portrait culture. Other people did as well, certainly, but I think they did it in a kind of special way.
Do you have a favorite photograph that's in this book?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I have a lot of favorites, but I think one of my favorites, which is probably the most disturbing photo, it's a kind of sad photo, but it's in the section with the nudes. There's a woman who's nude. She has only beads around the top of her calf, and she has some kind of beat up brogues, shoes, and a head tie. And that's really all that she's wearing. It's a series of four photographs. I don't know why I love them so much. There's something, you know, they're very mournful and there's something even so abject about them, but there's something very beautiful to me about them too. And, you know, that's a section in the book where I'm writing really about where sometimes this is all about clothing, but sometimes something as simple as the beads as the only object that she wears. And the beads are used to accentuate the beauty of the calves. It just kind of shows the irony of everything. Like here's somebody, you won't find nudes in any African studio. You only find them in the colonial studios. And here this woman is posed, but she's left her beads on. So the European gaze is fixated on the full body, on the nude. And her beauty or her power resides in those beads and the idea of the shaping of the calf. So the Europeans are all about the breast and, you know, for her, it's the shaping of the calf.
I'm just flipping through those four photos right now and they are stunning.
129 in the book.
Mm-hmm. They are stunning.
Then there are lots of others that I loved.
Why did you decide to put those in there in particular?
I don't know. They're so resonant to me. And it is one of the few places, like I didn't want to do a project that just keeps going back over the colonial gaze. You know, I'm trying to reach far beyond that. But those are photographs that really kind of accentuate what those politics are in a very stark way. So I think that's why they made their way in.
Yeah, I'm glad they did. What is the future of this collection? Are you continuing to collect or is it complete? Is this project complete now?
No, it's ongoing. I'll probably collect forever. It's obsessional at this point. But the idea to, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about wanting to make the archive part of a larger public realm. So I'm thinking a lot about collaborations with other artists. Frida Orpabo, who lives in Oslo and is Nigerian, did some collages for the book. And that was kind of the first collaboration that I did. But I'd like to do much more kind of public work with the photos. Like we're talking about doing some projections of some of the images onto buildings and spaces where they have resonance.
Wow.
And that sort of thing. So it's definitely ongoing. But I think a lot about, you know, particularly right now where museums are caught in these debates about ownership and where things belong and the politics of the whole legacy of acquiring certain objects. And the fact that I'm not African, that, you know, I own this archive, where does it belong? Who does it belong to? These are my ancestors, and yet I'm here in the West. I'm thinking a lot about what that legacy should be, where I'd like these things to go when I'm done caring for them. And I have invested a lot in caring for them because a lot of them came and were very, very damaged or, you know, need some kind of preservation work or and need to be stored well. And that costs a lot of money. So what will I want to do with them going forward? You know, where will they find a home beyond my house?
I think a good curator is constantly asking those questions of themselves, yeah. of whose ownership is here and what is right in this, at the same time feeling kind of protective of these photographs too, I'm sure. Well, we are winding down and this has been so fun to talk to you.
Yeah,
so I've learned so much. I learned so much in this book. It was a quick read because there is so much photography, but it is so packed with history, and anybody who's interested in art or fashion or history or politics or economics, it's all in here. And it's a really interesting, enjoyable read. So thank you for sharing your collection with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is great.
So we do wind up with two easy questions. And the first is, do you have a book to recommend that's not one of your own?
Yes, I would recommend Nadia Owusu. She is Ghanaian American and, oh God, what else? I'll remember. But she has a fantastic memoir called Aftershocks that is publishing this month with Simon & Schuster. And I just finished, it's wonderful. She's Armenian, Ghanaian, and American.
I have an advanced copy of that I am so excited to read. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that.
She's wonderful.
We will leave a link to that in the show notes, as well as a link to the African Lookbook and Indigo and the Book of Sarahs, all of your work. And where can we find you online if we want to learn more about what you're doing?
My collection website is www.themckinleycollection.com, and I'm updating it all the time. And I'm also on Instagram at CEMCK2.
Perfect. We will link it all. Thank you so, so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, 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 oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, oh, oh.
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.